Des Cahill is back at the sport.
Yeah, good morning, Cahill. Dublin County Board begin their search for a new manager this morning after Anthony Daly and his management team stepped down yesterday as managers of the Dublin senior hurling squad. Daly had hinted at a possible departure after they lost their hurling quarterfinal to Tipperary. The pinnacle of his tenure came in 2011. Dublin beat Kilkenny to win a league title for the first time in 65 years. And of course, last year they won their first Leinster championship in 52 years. Now, his name has been linked with the Galway manager's job, and speculation already starting on who may succeed Daly with Dublin. Names in the papers include Liam Sheedy, Ger Cunningham and Donal O'Cusick. Well, the man who has to go and seek a successor now is the Dublin chairman, Andy Kettle, and he joins us now. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Des.
It's one way of taking your mind off Sunday's football, I suppose.
Well, listen, sport, it can be cruel and it can be very good to you, but Anthony Daly was very, very good to Dublin Hurling.
Yeah, you and he had a close relationship, and certainly Dublin Hurling's in a stronger place now than when he arrived.
Not a doubt in the world. Anthony brought a lot to Dublin Hurling, and you're quite right. He formed relationships not alone with me, but with other members of the county board, and particularly with his panel.
What was your standout moment from his time?
My standout moment was the league final in Croke Park when Conal Keeney put a point over from practically the tunnel area of the Hogan Stand. Was just sublime obviously, but also to get there the day in Park and Cuive where we had to have a result go our way when we beat Cork. All of those days, they conjure up superb memories.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you have to move on now. And is there a rush to get the new manager?
Well, I wouldn't say there's a rush, Des. Number one, we have to be sure that we get the right person. Like I did hear you say that there's names speculated in the media this morning. Complete news to me. As far as Dublin County Board are concerned, we have a blank spot where the name of Anthony Daly sat as a senior hurling manager. The process is that we will obviously approach some people, and some people will obviously approach us. We will evaluate those candidates and assess from our point of view who can do the best job for Dublin going forward. I would like to see it happen for the knockout stages of our local championship. That's a reasonably tight timeline. But if it doesn't happen for that, it's not the end of the world.
So, and that's kind of about a month's time. Would that be
that's
right?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay. Well, I wish you well with it, Andy. Thanks for talking to us this morning.
Not a problem.
Thank you very much. That's Dublin chairman Andy Kettle there. Now, the soccer headlines today dominated by transfer deadline day. Manchester United had to work late into the night to finalise the signing of the Monaco striker Radamel Falcao, but they eventually completed a season-long loan for the Colombian. They only announced his signing at 1:30 a.m. and that deal took United's summer spending past £150 million sterling. By that time, Arsenal had confirmed United striker Danny Welbeck had joined them for a reported fee of £16 million after Falcao's arrival made his chances of regular first-team football even more remote. And the presence of the Colombia international at the club's training complex late on Monday also spelled the end for Javier Hernandez, who earlier in the day joined Real Madrid on loan with a view to a permanent move. United will pay Monaco between £5 million and £6 million for Falcao for the year, and they'll cover his wages, although they insist reports that they'll be paying the 28-year-old almost £350,000 sterling a week are wide of the mark. Manchester City confirmed Alvaro Negredo has been sent on loan to Valencia, and Mika Richards has gone to the Italian side Fiorentina. Crystal Palace signed Kevin Doyle on loan from Wolves and broke their club record to sign the £7 million Wigan midfielder James McArthur. Premier League spending has been boosted by a £3 billion television deal, 70% higher than the last contract, and that's why so much money was moving around yesterday. On the pitch at home, St Patrick's Athletic advanced the quarterfinals of the FAI Ford Cup. They beat Shelburne 1-0 at Talca Park. Conan Byrne scored the goal, and St Pat's will face Bohemians in the last eight at Richmond Park. Now golf, and Paul McGinley will announce his three Ryder Cup wildcard selections at 12:30 today. Stephen Gallagher's Italian Open showing boosted his wildcard hopes, but Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood, Luke Donald, Francesco Molinari are also big contenders. So who would our golf commentator Greg Allen select?
I would certainly pick Stephen Gallagher. I think he was just superb in showing him under pressure what he had to do with the Italian Open, having almost missed the cut, shot 30 strokes in the front nine on Sunday, and then, you know, didn't stall, but he just didn't make as many birdies in the back nine and missed out by one stroke on getting an automatic spot. He did exactly what Paul McGinley asked him to do, which was burst through the finishing line, didn't quite make it. And I think, irrespective of the fact that he's a Scot, I think he deserves his place in the team on form alone.
But it's no disadvantage that he's a Scot, obviously.
Certainly no disadvantage. Yeah. Lives 35 miles away from Ochterarder, where Gleneagles is located, and that's sort of going to help to some degree, because he'll also be a Scot on a European team that's playing the Ryder Cup in Scotland. Not a bad thing.
So that's one.
I think that the second spot should go to Ian Poulter. It is very much on reputation, but Poulter was the hero of Medina. I know it's 2 years ago. He's not playing as well at the moment, but he still remains a very good putter. So if needs be, you can stick him in the four balls with a very good player alongside him who's very steady. Say McIlroy, who he played with in four ball in that famous turnaround match on the Saturday in Medina. And you've got a very good putter, because that's what you need in four ball. You can rest him for the foursomes, and then obviously he has to play the singles, and then he's on his own at that point. Lee Westwood, I think, probably deserves it by a fraction from Luke Donald, because Westwood has played 8 Ryder Cups. He has great presence in the team room. Luke Donald is still in the process of changing his swing, and I don't like the idea of putting a player under pressure who's still in that delicate process of changing his swing and putting him under the ultimate pressure of Ryder Cup. But it's very close between Donald and Westwood, because Donald has a great record in foursome.
Interesting stuff, and Greg will bring us news of that on the news at 1 today. Now, American Chris Kirk boosted his chances of a place in the US team with a 2-shot victory last night in the Deutsche Bank Championship. He finished on 15 under par. Rory McIlroy had to settle for a share of 5th place at 11 under. Finally, tennis news. Andy Murray threw to the quarterfinals of the US Open. He beat Joe Wilfried Tsonga in straight sets. And a big game now, he plays the world number one Novak Djokovic.
Oh, thank you very much, Des. You're a new student in the Institute of Technology in Sligo. There's a new building opening there, which is going to be significant for many of you and for many future pupils and for the college and the Northwest generally. It's the brand new science building at the Institute of Technology, which will be opened by the Taoiseach later on. And our science and technology correspondent, Will Goodbody, is there to tell us more. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Cathal. Thank you. And good morning from the bright and shiny surroundings of the new MacMun building here in Sligo. A €17 million addition to Sligo Institute of Technology and part of a 5-year, €35 million redevelopment of the campus. In a moment, we'll hear about the scientist whose name has been given to the building, the science that'll be done here, and the links with local businesses. But first, I'm joined by Terry Scott, the outgoing president of IT Sligo. Terry, what kind of facilities does this new building have and how is it paid for?
Well, thanks very much and good morning, Will. The new building is a 4,500 square metre facility. On the ground floor, we have a 600-seater restaurant for staff and students. In the science block itself, we have a Natey station, a first-year laboratory, and we have 4 new teaching laboratories and 8 research laboratories. So it's a wonderful new facility. We're delighted to have it and delivered on time and on budget.
Paid for by who?
By IT Sligo.
And the funding, was it a mixture of philanthropic and state, or where did it come from?
No, we've had great support over the last number of years from local business and industry, and obviously we've had support from the Department of Education on other projects, but this project is funded entirely from the college's own resources.
How much of a challenge is it, though, on an ongoing basis to attract, I guess, science capital and research funding, particularly from philanthropic sources, when you are an institute of technology and based outside of Dublin?
It is a challenge, there's no doubt about it, and what we have decided here is to build the facility and ensure that we attract the calibre of staff, that we retain the quality and calibre of our research facility, and importantly that the students that graduate each year are a testament to the progress that we've made. So importantly for us, our relationship with the local industry, the regional industry, and nationally with the partners like GSK, MSD, that are so important to IT Sligo's future and really important to this region and growing the capability.
Sitting beside you here is Dr. Jeremy Burge, the head of the School of Science here at IT Sligo. Jeremy, you've named the building after the 19th century scientist Charles MacMun. Who was he and why was he so important?
Well, Charles McMahon was born in 1852 in West Sligo. He studied medicine at Trinity College Dublin, and he moved on to Wolverhampton to practice medicine. But he actually conducted research in the loft of his house for many years on a series of pigments, which we now know as a cytochrome system. And this has become a fundamental cornerstone of modern biochemistry.
And tell me about the kind of science that will be carried out here. Forensics is one area that you're very big in.
Yeah, forensics is an area. We have an honours degree and a level 7 degree in forensics. But altogether, we have 7 honours degrees spanning a number of areas across environmental science and life sciences. We have a very important pharmaceutical science honours degree, which obviously links up with the later discussion we're going to have about GSK. So altogether, we have 1,100 students in the school. So I think, you know, for a science school outside Dublin, we punch above our weight. We're very large.
And you also have a fairly significant online and growing online presence when it comes to online courses and online training.
That's correct, yes. We have over 500 students, online students now, currently spanning a number of degree programs, but principally many of them focus around pharmaceutical science and biopharmaceutical science, and obviously that relates to our relationship with the National Institute for Bioprocessing, which we're part of the consortium of.
And for all institutions carrying out scientific research, such links to industry are becoming increasingly significant. And here in Sligo, it's no different. Kevin Wright is site manager for the skincare manufacturing company Stiefel, which is owned by GSK, and they have a large presence here in the town. Kevin, is it important for companies like Stiefel to have a research facility like this one here at IT Sligo nearby and on your doorstep, I suppose?
Yes, it's very important to us. Stiefel, as you said, is a GSK company here based in Sligo, and we specialise in dermatology and skin science. We produce over 30 million prescription and over-the-counter skincare products like Eylatum and Physiogel, and we export to 70 countries. The link for us with IT Sligo is vital because it gives us a highly skilled science graduate, and that's very important to build the capability of our employees also at the site.
And compared to, I suppose, the bigger universities in Ireland, though, how do ITs like Sligo compare when it comes to their, I suppose, willingness to forge links within the industry, carry out joint research, commercialise findings, that kind of thing?
Their willingness is great. I mean, we've a very good collaboration with IT Sligo going back over 30 years, and it's been very important for us. They've helped us develop, and we've a collaboration on a two-year distance learning course, and that's helping developing our employees and our capability, and it ensures the future of the Sligo site, and it's vital to us.
Terry Scott, back to you. In terms of the uptake of science courses here at Sligo, have you seen the school and the intake grow over the last number of years?
Well, absolutely. And we know, Jerry had said about our online programmes, but an area that's very important for us is interdisciplinary programmes that will take some science, some engineering, with options for students to take business programmes. We have a strong quality management provision in our School of Engineering. So together with our engineering design and business programmes, we can assure that we offer business and the students coming to IC Sligo the best possible opportunities for the future.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm afraid the clock is against us, and unfortunately we must leave it there. But my thanks to my guests, who are now off to finish polishing the test tubes and the beakers prior to the Taoiseach's arrival in just over half an hour's time. But for now, it's back to you in studio.
Thank you very much, Will. Two men from the same part of Dublin, just off the North Quays, are to be made Freemen of the City. The decision was made by the City Council last night. Brother Kevin Crowley founded the great Capuchin Day Centre in Bow Street, whose food parcels and meals and other kinds of care have been vital for the growing number of people hit by hard times in the city in recent years. The other Freeman grew up a short distance away on the other side of Church Street. He needs no introduction. But in brief, just in case he'd been on another planet for the last half century, he's one of the country's greatest ever footballers, many would say the greatest. And on television as a soccer analyst, there can be no argument, he is the best. John Giles, good morning.
Good morning, Carl.
How did you?
That's a good build-up, Carl. Thank you very much.
Well, I do my best. Congratulations. How did you hear this news?
Well, I heard it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I got a phone call to say that this might well be happening, and to keep it quiet. Which I did, I think, Cahill, anyway.
The word leaked out, but there was never going to be any disagreement about this. What does it mean to you?
Well, it's great. You know, when I started playing football and growing up as a young boy in Norman Square, I never ever thought about or had any great ambitions to be a free man of the city, but didn't realise what it was, to be quite honest. But over the years, I have realised, and it's a great honour. It's great for the family. It's great for my friends and people, I think, in Ormond Square as well, who are still alive from when I was there. And, of course, the football community. I think it's a great honour for everybody.
I'm sure you've been asked this. In fact, I may have asked you, but I'll ask it anyway because I'm curious, and I think most people listening to you would be. What was your greatest moment, the one you treasure most in football?
Well, probably the one I would remember most and have the most affection for would be my first international at Dalymount Park. Because when I was a young fella growing up in Gorman Square, I went to most, my father took me to most of the international matches. And like most kids, you want to play, and not at that time in Dalymount, in the international team. And I was very lucky that after only two matches playing in the first team for Manchester United, I was picked to play for Ireland. And we played Sweden at Dalymount Park in 1959. And it was a good Swedish team. They'd been runners-up in the World Cup the previous year in 58. They had just beaten England at Wembley on the Wednesday. And we used to play on the Saturday and come over on the Sunday. And we were 2-0 down. And I was lucky enough to score a very, very good goal to go on and win 3-2. So, you know, it was something I obviously wanted to play for Manchester United when I was a kid. But playing for Ireland was huge to me because I was playing alongside some of my heroes like Noel Cantwell and Charlie Hurley and Pat Sayward and Joe Haverty that I'd idolised only a few, two or three years before from the terraces or the stands where my father used to take me.
Your old club, with whom you achieved great success, but they've fallen, as everyone knows, on pretty hard times since then. Are you sentimental about it? How much would it matter to you? And do you see any prospect of them getting back into the big time?
I don't see any prospect at the moment, Carl, with this fellow that they have in charge. I think it's dreadful. I would have a great deal of feeling for the supporters and sentiment towards the club because I was 12 years there. But particularly the supporters. I mean, some of those supporters that were there when I was there are still going, and their sons, and all the various things that happen at football clubs. And they have a great feel for the club and great support. The lead support is absolutely brilliant. I feel sorry for them, and I think it's dreadful that the club is in the shape that it's in. It's absolutely dreadful.
All right. Just one word before you go, John, about part of your work that people mightn't know about. The John Giles Foundation, how important is that to you and its work?
Well, it is, Kyle. I played at, obviously, schoolboy football when I was a kid. People put a lot of work into it, and without their efforts, I wouldn't have gone on to be a professional footballer and played for Ireland. And I think kids now need facilities more than ever before. In my day, you could play in the streets, and it was safe. It's not safe anymore. So they need the facilities more than ever. And the foundation helps clubs. We raise some money, and it goes out in grants to the clubs that need it at grassroots level. So I'm delighted to do it. I meet a lot of people around the country, and they're absolutely brilliant, Kyle. The work they put into it is great, and it's all voluntary work, and it's a great effort. And I enjoy doing it.
Well, congratulations again to you and to brother Kevin Crowley. As I say, I don't think it often happens that two people who are so closely linked geographically in the city are going to be there on the same day. It's going to be a great day, and well done. John Giles, thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's a minute to nine.
To those government flying problems, now one of the government jets used for ministerial travel has been grounded. Shane Phelan, the public affairs editor of the Irish Independent, has the story. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Fran.
What can you tell us?
Well, the government has two jets which are routinely used for ministerial travel. One is a Learjet, the other is a Gulfstream jet. And the Gulfstream jet flew to Georgia in the United States for a routine maintenance check about 5 weeks ago, and it hasn't come back. It's been grounded since then. Some problems were found out there with the undercarriage of the aircraft. And it's leaving the government with a rather tricky decision to make. The Department of Defense has basically doesn't have the budget for large-scale repairs or indeed the money to buy a replacement aircraft. So the Defence Minister, Simon Coveney, is due to bring a report to the Cabinet on this shortly, but they're faced with the prospect of having to shell out quite a large sum of money to get this jet back in the air or to buy a new one.
And the irony is, Shane, that when the Minister was appointed to the Defence portfolio just a short time ago, in the official briefing that was given to him by his officials in the Department of Defence, this was flagged, the fact that there were issues, it was ageing, if further issues arose with it, it would likely be grounded, and there was no provision for a replacement.
Yes, Mr. Coveney was told that this jet's been on the go for 23 years now, and has clocked up quite a lot of air miles, 13,170 flying hours recorded on it already, and even though there has been something of a decrease in use of the government jets under the current coalition compared to previous governments, there's still been quite a lot of flying. The Taoiseach and the former Taoiseach Eamon Gilmore would have racked up over 130 journeys between them up to May of this year, for example. Michael Noonan uses it quite a bit, obviously, over and back from Brussels for meetings there. So the jets are used quite a lot, and it's going to be a bit of a problem for the country. I think the argument can be made that we do need to have these on the go. We're trying to sell the country, and particularly we can't have certain ministers hanging around airports all the time. You know, they need to get back and things like that. So a big headache for the government, and it'll be interesting to see what they do if the money can be found.
And all of that said, there is nothing like talk of government jets, Learjets and Gulfstreams to get people's back up. But it also presents something of a political difficulty, doesn't it, if money has to be spent? I think you're saying this morning something like 40 million for a new plane, but 4 or 5, up to 5 million to replace this one with something of a similar age.
Yeah, if you were to look for a second-hand Gulfstream of similar vintage, similar spec, you'd be looking at in the region of 3 to 4 million euro. A new plane that they're selling for 40 million in the United States. So, the figures are there are fairly eye-watering.
Did the department or the minister have anything to say on this last night?
They confirmed that there were problems with the jet, and basically said that the minister would be preparing a report for the government. Ultimately, it'll be a decision for the cabinet as to whether or not as to what happens next, what course of action they take, and what sort of money is available.
All right, Shane Phelan, public affairs editor of the Irish Independent. Thanks for speaking to us this morning.